It's 5 o'clock, you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, 90.9 on cable, and streaming on the web at www.cfrc.ca. We're broadcasting live from the basement of Crothers Hall at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and you're now tuned in to Radio 613. Shalom Aleichem, welcome to the show. My name is Avi, and you are tuned in to Radio 613 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Hope everyone's having a really great week, and I'm looking forward to the show. This week we'll be featuring an interview that I did with Dorit Naaman, who's a film theorist and documentarist from Jerusalem, who now teaches at the Queen's University Film Department here in Kingston. Her research focuses on Middle Eastern cinemas, primarily from post-colonialist and feminist perspectives, and she is currently working on a book on the visual representation of Palestinian and Israeli women fighters. So Dorit developed a format of short videos, and they're part of her Daya documentary series, or diary documentary series, and she screened her most recent film in Kingston in September. It was the Kingston premiere, and it was followed and interspersed with a really great discussion that Dorit led, and I certainly appreciate the chance to speak with her this week. And based on the nature of most of her films, which are primarily set again in and around her hometown of Jerusalem, the conversation focused a lot on issues around her own displacement from the place that she considered home, as well as the large-scale displacement primarily of Palestinians in the region. And again, the most recent part of the series, Two Houses and a Longing, tells the story of two Palestinian homes. The people who lived in the house in 48 fled or were driven out during the 1948 war, and one of the houses is now a Israeli Museum of Tolerance, is the title. And Dorit will speak a little bit about how her film challenges some of the narrative that museum presents. And next week we're going to be sort of following up on this theme, talking about how Canadian museums put forward the Canadian national colonialist narrative, and how Canadian museums sort of are used as a museums being a place that we normally would think talking about history are actually used to erase Indigenous history here on Turtle Island. And here is my interview with Dorit Naaman on Radio 613, CFRC 101.9 FM. I'm here in studio with Dorit Naaman. Dorit, thanks very much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
I was wondering if you could begin by telling us about this Daya documentary series and how and why you developed this concept for documentary filmmaking.
It is a format that I'm working on that plays with diary, autobiographical film, and documentary, which tends to be more removed and more attempting to adhere to facts or exposing a certain social reality. And it mostly came out of my frustration with the way that things are represented, especially when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the reality of Jerusalem. So I felt that most of what I was watching being made was too, not necessarily one-sided, but too reductive. So I wanted to show something that was less complete, less conclusive, more evocative, more multifaceted, and short. And these videos are very, very short.
You began this Daya documentary series 2003, is that right?
Yeah, and I actually began it with my only piece to date that was shot here in Kingston at Fort Henry and dealt with Canadian nationalism. And it was during the 1812 event where they play Tchaikovsky's 1812 and a lot of other stuff, such as Star Wars and Lion King and music from E.T. And I used that to talk about Canadian nationalism a little bit and me moving from the U.S. to Canada after 9/11, but coming from Israel, and both U.S. and Israel, hyper-nationalistic cultures, and then my hope that in Canada I will find a refuge from it, and then finding out that nationalism just takes different forms here. So that was the first piece, and to date there are 7, and the 6 others are all in and around Jerusalem.
So the first one in the series, Salem Jeru, it's starts actually with your a shot of your home, so can't get much more personal beginning to the series, at least in when it's filmed in Jerusalem. Tell us why you began with your home there.
You know, when you immigrate, the whole issue of home becomes really, really important. And I've been in North America now for 17 years, and I moved a lot. And the past 6 years, I've been here at Queens and living in Kingston and working very actively to have a home here. So I had a notion that I wanted to do something about multiplicity of homes, losing one's home, all of that. And it coincided with my parents sold the house that I grew up in, partly because they became uncomfortable with the fact that it was outside of the 67 borders. So it was actually on occupied Palestinian land. In a sense, and no one uses that term when you talk about Jerusalem, but in a sense, we were settlers. And we didn't want to be that, or my parents didn't want to be that. And so they sold their house, and I videotaped a little bit around that time. I went for a visit to say goodbye to the house, and I did some videotaping. And later I became a little more involved in a campaign against the demolition of Palestinian houses, which is especially rampant around Jerusalem. So while 80% of building violations, building without proper permits, happen in West Jerusalem, which is the Israeli side, 80% of the demolitions of houses happen in East Jerusalem, which is the Palestinian side. And so it led to a series of 2 videos that deal with issues of home. And in both of these videos, I talk about the loss of my home in Jerusalem, and in the other one, Home Bittersweet Home, also about the building of my home here.
Did you want to elaborate a little bit more on the work you were doing against house demolitions?
Yeah, there is an Israeli organization called the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. I highly recommend you to check their website. It's rich and very interesting website. And they have been actively campaigning against house demolitions. They try to go, when they know a house is about to be demolished, they try to go and use non-violent resistance tactics, but stay there, interfere. And more recently, in the past few years, they have embarked on an incredible rebuilding campaign. So they rebuild the homes of Palestinians whose houses have been demolished. And I have to emphasize here that all these houses have been demolished not because these people are terrorists or their families have... sometimes Israel demolishes houses of the families of suicide bombers, even though all evidence is that that is not a deterrent. On the contrary, that's only creating a lot of more frustrated and highly disenfranchised Palestinian people. But the majority of the demolitions, over 90% of the demolitions, happen just because these houses do not have proper permits. And the catch is that Israel hasn't been giving permits. Since 1967, they have given under 50 permits to Palestinians. So this is a population that's growing and cannot expand, are living under incredibly crowded housing conditions, and often they just add a story or add a room for a son who got married, and then Israel comes and demolishes it. And what the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition has been doing is they bring together Israeli volunteers, international volunteers, and Palestinian volunteers. They do these summer camps, and they build these homes, which might be demolished again, but are also a sign of hope for a whole community, not just for one family. So I found that kind of activism incredibly inspiring, and I wanted to do a documentary about the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. All kinds of things happen, and I ended up doing it just on one person, Salim Shawamer, and about my own childhood home.
Great. So from the shot of your home at the beginning of Salim Drew, you're the car, it's basically filming from a car driving along various roads in Jerusalem that divide Jewish Jerusalem, if we can say that, and Palestinian Jerusalem. And you mentioned that a lot of the borders are actually invisible borders. This is not a part of Jerusalem that's being separated by the wall that's being built, but there's more sort of lines. You say Palestinians know, in the film you narrate, Palestinians know not to cross it. They know the repercussions, the violence that will ensue. I was sort of struck by this idea of actually violence occurring even when it's not occurring. In other words, it's the film itself is, compared to other films about really tense, violent situations, this is rather mundane at first glance, just driving in a car, but at the same time you get a very strong sense, I think, of the violence that's occurring just by this invisible border existing and preventing movement, because there is that knowledge of very severe repercussions.
I think that what happened with Jerusalem is very interesting. Jerusalem until 1948 was a mixed city. So there were Palestinian neighborhoods and there were Jewish neighborhoods, and there were mixed neighborhoods, and they were interspersed. And what happened at the end of the 48 war, Jerusalem was divided between Jordan occupied the eastern part and Israel occupied the western part, and no Palestinians were left in the western part of Jerusalem. They were all actively expelled and driven out. So since then, West Jerusalem is considered Israeli and East Jerusalem is considered Palestinian. In 67, Israel conquered Jerusalem from Jordan, went all the way to the Jordan River, east of the Jordan River. And one of the first things they did was they passed a law that Jerusalem is united and shall never be divided again. And so there are no checkpoints inside Jerusalem. There is nothing. If you're a tourist, you may not even know where the Palestinian city starts and where the Israeli city ends. But every Jerusalemite, whether they're Jewish or Palestinian, know that. Israeli or Palestinian, they know that. And the Israelis don't cross into the eastern part of town either. They're afraid. They're afraid of violence. So it's a very real border for Jerusalemites, and it's completely invisible border in every other way, because it's just a road.
The next film in the series that I want to talk about is Market Song. And it's, I guess you could say, a somewhat nostalgic film about visiting the market with your mother, who's featured in the film, and you're at your favorite market in Jerusalem.
Yeah, I think in the series, the videos range. Some are much more documentary-like, some are more personal, some are more like video installations, like the last one, which we will discuss in a little bit. The Market Song is definitely the most personal and the most nostalgic. And this is a ritual that my mother and I do every time I go for a visit. And we go to the Jerusalem market. There is a market in the Old City. It's a Palestinian market, and this is the market in the Israeli city, and it's called Shuk Machne Yehuda, and it's a very old market. And it's the place where the fruits and vegetables are incredibly fresh. You can buy olives, you can buy cheese, you can eat hummus, you can... Now there are actually quite upscale cafes and restaurants and boutiques as well. So I wouldn't say the market is becoming gentrified completely, but it's changing its character a little bit. It's a lively, interesting place, and food is a big part of Jewish culture and certainly of my culture. And it's also the one aspect that I unabashedly miss and have no complications around. So it is my most nostalgic piece.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to hear now actually the audio from that film, Market Song. What is the song that's played?
The song is called Ha'agas Echad. Ha'agas means the pear, and it's the name of the street. All the names of the streets in the market are after fruits. There's the walnut and apple and pear. And Echad means number one, so it's number one Pear Street. And that's the address of the grandfather of the songwriter and singer, and he's a popular, very interesting singer in Israel. He comes from a family that was in Palestine before the Zionists came, so they have some what used to be called Sephardic or Mizrahi origin, very well integrated, and they're a group that is somewhat in between Ashkenazi or Western European culture and Mizrahi or Middle Eastern Jewish culture, and you can hear that in the music. You know, often people call it fusion, but I think it's just a music that mixes elements of Middle Eastern and also elements of Western music.
Thank you.
Okay, that sounds from Dorit Naaman's film The Market Song, with music by Ehud Banai and the song Ha'agas Echad. And Dorit, you mentioned you wanted to speak a little bit about the process of producing soundtracks for your films.
I explained how there is this very visible and real border for Israelis and Palestinians, but one of the things where this border is violated is with music, and especially with radio. So if you go on the dial off the radio in your radio, in your car, whatever, something we don't do because we have digital stations now, but you used to do with the knob, it's striking how many radio stations exist in Jerusalem. And you get everything from classical music, Western pop music, Israeli popular music, Israeli folk music, Israeli Middle Eastern music, Hasidic music, Palestinian or Arab prayer, Arab pop music, talk shows, everything. So what I've done for the soundtrack for Salem Jeru is I just go on the dial with an old knob. I just taped, I put a cassette player, and I just taped what I heard. And this is what I'm playing for the soundtrack. And what's amazing about it is that even though it's available, that is kind of, for me, a vertical existence in Jerusalem. Everyone exists in Jerusalem. People of all kinds, with all kinds of associations, with Western desires to live their cultural life as a Western entity, whether it's old Ashkenazi generations who listen mostly to classical music, or whether it's young people who listen mostly to punk or hip-hop or whatever it is that is imported, or whether it's local culture, whether it's in Arabic, whether it's in Hebrew, whether it's in Yiddish, it's all there. But we listen selectively, and we mark our stations. And I never, until I've done that exercise for the soundtrack of this video, I never realized how many radio stations there were that play music and content in Arabic. I just honestly didn't know. So it was an amazing experience, and I think the soundtrack reflects that.
It's good to know that those borders are somewhat eroded, at least on the radio dial.
Yeah.
So Jerusalem Walls, I really like the tone of Jerusalem Walls. It's presented, this is the, I guess, one of the middle installments of Dorit's Yodaya documentary series, and it's sort of presented as a guided tour. You do a lot of panoramic perspectives of Jerusalem and its walls. Maybe actually you can tell the listeners about this piece, and I'll tell you why I really liked it.
So it's actually one shot, 270-degree pan, that starts in an old windmill, which was the first windmill and actually the first neighborhood that was built outside of the old city wall in the 1880s. And it goes through the panning through the walls of the old city of Jerusalem and then into the new wall that Israel erects, an 8-meter cement wall that separates basically Palestine from Palestine. It's lying east of Jerusalem in Jerusalem. In other places, it's in around the West Bank. It's in different routes. And the wall that I'm filming is in a village called Abu Dis, which lies on a hilltop east of Jerusalem. And I set it as a discourse of archaeology and history and tourism. And partly because part of the way that Israel bridged over a gap of, or Zionism bridged a gap of 2,000 years of hardly any Jewish existence from the Roman expulsion to diaspora in 135 on to the return of the Zionists in the 19th century, there was a big gap. And one of the ways they bridged over that was by connecting, creating a very strong connection to the history of the Bible period and onwards to the Roman era. And so archaeology is incredibly important in cementing that, and history. And I was a nature guide. That was my army service. I wasn't actually in the army, which is mandatory for all Israelis. I was lent from the army to a nonprofit organization called the Society for the Protection of Nature that does guided tours for high school, elementary school and high school kids primarily, sometimes also groups that come from abroad and families. And it's basically, the way I see it now, it's Zionist indoctrination. So it ties the connection. This is our land. And the story kind of ends with the expulsion and resumes itself with the Zionist waves and everything that happened in between, especially the Byzantine time that was incredibly fruitful and a fertile period, in the Persian period, the Arab period. All of that is kind of erased from this story. So from my newish perspective about Israel and Palestine and the way that history forms our identity and the way that our history is always selective, it's always in a sense a story, his story maybe, I made that piece. And the second aspect of that is that I was I can be rational about all of that, and I can talk about everything that happens there. I can talk about the loss of my country for me and the loss of the values that I grew up in. And I can talk about all of that calmly until I stand by this 8-meter cement wall. It's so overbearing. It is so depressing that I always start to cry there. And so it's also a meditation. This piece is a meditation about what this wall is doing to us Israelis, not only to the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. I think that you can tell that you have experience as a guided tour. you have the tone of a tour guide down really well, and to me it is reminiscent of my experience of Jerusalem, which is a lot of guided tours. And unfortunately, I've only been to Jerusalem once, and it's a beautiful time, but it was a lot of official tours and a lot of that nationalist narrative and story, which as you mentioned, really excluded and erased a lot of the history of that place. And it's sort of nice and to hear sort of someone reappropriating that tone in a way that breaks down some of that narrative. Something I think is effective and could be used here, as this is a sort of dual struggle for myself of breaking down the colonial narratives that I have learned, both with regard to Israel-Palestine and Canada Turtle Island, and the relationship of settlers to the land and issues around ownership and erasing indigenous culture. And I think we'll talk about that a little later, but I think it's a nice way to sort of challenge the official tour.
You know, I have to say something here about documentary in general and this discourse of sobriety and documentary comes about, is born at the height of the colonial moment. So 80% of the earth mass is controlled by Euro-Caucasian powers, and documentary comes as a vehicle for anthropologists and sociologists to go and record all these indigenous cultures and bring them back for consumption in metropolitan centers, first in Europe and in North America. So a Canadian classic, Nanook of the North from 1922, beautiful, romantic, charming film, also completely orientalizes the Inuit people and romanticizes them, makes them frozen in time. But the discourse is a discourse of knowledge and information. So there is a power of documentaries to align themselves with dominant ideologies in many, many ways, not only about colonialism, about gender dynamics, about all kinds of other power and social and political dynamics. And the voice of the documentary, which seems to be so factual, if not objective, at least accurate, historical, full of evidence, is always telling a story that's ideological, that's partial, and that is often the story of the winners. So how do we make space within this genre for the stories of the losers? And that's a big question for me.
Mm-hmm. I wonder where you draw inspiration from in that, in sort of critical anti-colonial filmmaking tradition. I'd like to hear from you. I've been sort of watching a lot of sort of French post-colonial, anti-colonial films mm-hmm. recently for some reason, and Battle of Algiers, and I think Le Pied de Cochon or something, really excellent, and not really documentaries, but of course the sort of French filmmaking style, even if it's not documentary, is sort of documentary-ish. You know, there's these sort of existential moments where you realize, you know, the cameras, people are looking directly into the camera, this sort of thing, and sort of using that documentary style, but in an extraordinarily powerful way to expose sort of that colonial narrative. I'm not exactly versed in those techniques and what is, you know, potentially effective or not, but I wonder if there's something that area or people that you draw upon.
Yeah. I think the Battle of Algiers was a crucial film for me. I saw it the first year I was in first year film studies at Tel Aviv University in Israel, and I saw that film. It was also the first year of the first Intifada, and I remember thinking, "Oh my gosh, this is about us." So it was a really crucial moment for me. But in a more organized way, for me, really feminist criticism, especially feminist film criticism, but not only, is what opened the door, both politically, to see that. What are the real implications of accepting that as human beings we're equal, or we should have equal rights? And equal rights mean equal rights to be different. And so how do we facilitate that? And inspiration for me is the work of Trinh Minh Ha, Vietnamese-American filmmaker, Ria Tajiri, Japanese-American filmmaker, the writing of Gloria Anzaldúa, who passed away a few years ago, fantastic book called Borderlands, U.S.-Mexico Border, John Sayles' film, Lone Star, for instance, a fiction film about the U.S., Mexico-Texas-Mexico border. And so these films are inspirational for me as well as many others.
We should get them screened in Kingston soon.
Yeah.
Sometime. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about the most recent film in the Dai documentary series, Two Houses and a Longing.
Rujuayat. Unadikum. Ashuddu ala ayadikum. Abusu al-arda tahta ni'alikum. Wa aqulu afdikum. Wa ahdikum diya'ini. Wa dif'a al-qalbi a'tikum. فمأساة التي أحيا نصيبي من مآسيكم
كل السفن تفوتنا تارك الحزن يغرق قلوبنا راضي نكون ضيوف الظلم ببيوتنا والآية انقلبت كمان مرة صرنا ضيوف اللي غير مرغوب فينا مكتوب لنا نضلنا راب على أرضنا بعاد من وطننا مين يهم همنا مطمطي يجرب دمنا حكمنا حكم صهيوني ديمقراطي ديمقراطي للنفس الصهيونية وصهيوني للنفس العربية يعني الممنوع لو ممنوع للمسموح لو ممنوع للمسموح لمكروه لي لأنه ينكر كياني محى ومازال يمحي الواني تاريخ ناس جدادي يغسل دماغ ولاد التوعى حاضر ما يمثلها جنسية زنان بالله ونشرب ميتها طولنا ان احنا من الشعب والشعب حسسنا ان احنا غربة انا غريب في بلادي
لوين
نظر
اشارات ارفنانا همسات سبانا اشارات طردانا اهرانا ناسي انو جدادنا اسسوا المباني واخواننا ما زال عمره اساسا واساس سعر بالمسجد والدير واخيرها ناس من بلاد غير تصرخ لي ترانسفير احنا شاكلنا قوانين هاضمه حقوقنا كاتمه صوتنا داخل خط الاخضر هاتمه بيوتنا البطاله تهمنا نربى فقر وفقر الرب يقولنا لكن تحي قلوبنا اللي تحيي جذورنا اللي ينادونا خونا خونا
لا لا لا
أنا ما هنت في وطني مآسي شعبي كتبت لقدري العالم لليوم عملنا إسرائيليين وإسرائيل لبكرة عملنا فلسطينيين غريب في بلادي
قدر قريب لما الحجر بالإيد 13 شهيد علاء وطننا عماد وطننا أكتوبر الأسود أثبت إنه الإياد بدمنا إذا الكل فيهم وليد تحت الاحتلال كيف مش رامي الماضي برمي حاله كالسيف الماضي يعارك سلاح الحاسب ضمنا مي يقتل الصوت المسلح برصاصه الحي ودمعة الأم تصيح أنا أسيل عخد عرب محمد والمسيح يا جبل ما يهزنا ريح نضل رامز القومية وسام الحرية شعلة أجداد دمور الروح الشبابية أنا غريب ببلادي لكن احمد ربني متمسك بتراسي نادوني خاين عربي الداخل 48 ويدك عراسك احنا جذور فلسطين لطول العمر
لوين اروح الغربة احتلت داري قالت للروح حضن اهلك يحمل غالي
لوين اروح اخواتي مهتم حالي
قالت للروح
وصمت العشبة فوق قبور أسلافي أناديكم أشد على أياديكم.
That was Garib Fli Bladi, or Stranger in My Own Country by Dam, here on Radio 613 on CFRC 101.9 FM. We're back in studio with Queen's film professor and documentary filmmaker Dorit Naaman. And the final film we're going to be talking about today had its Kingston premiere in September, premiered at the Boston Palestine Film Festival in October, and the Jerusalem Film Festival this summer. And it's Two Houses and a Longing, a story of two Palestinian homes whose owners fled during the 1948 war. One of the houses is now a daycare center, and the other is a museum. So Dorit, tell us a little bit more about this film, Two Houses and a Longing.
2 years ago, I went to Israel for 6 months, so I rented an apartment in a neighborhood called Katamon, which is an Arab neighborhood, and actually I learned through my research that it's actually comes from Greek, and it means near the monastery, and there's a big monastery on the top of the hill that's a Greek Orthodox monastery. Katamon was built in the 1930s by affluent Palestinian residents of Jerusalem, and it was housed with Palestinians and some British officers of the British mandate. The Brits controlled what's called British Palestine from 1918 to 1948. And in 1948, it was very important to Israel, for Israel to get control of that neighborhood because the hilltop was very high, and so they had a very fierce battle over the monastery, which they barely won, but did, and they actively evacuated kicked out the residents, whoever was left. Very few were left in the last few days because the shelling was so horrendous. And so the entire neighborhood is Palestinian, and most houses have very, very big Israeli flags on them. And I noticed that a tour stops by the house right next door to me, and then with, you know, utmost serendipity, and the article was published in the paper about a few Palestinian houses, and sure enough, the house right next door to me is mentioned too with a picture. And it was the house of a very important Palestinian intellectual, Khalil Sakakini. He was a self-educated philosopher, educator, political thinker, and public intellectual. He was an incredible person and a poet. And he established a formal education system in Palestine. He revolutionized the system of studying from memorizing to actual conversation argumentation. He revolutionized the language, the Arabic language. He tried to make it less formal and more spoken. And he ended up, at the end of his days, he was a member of the Arab Language Academy, which is an incredibly prestigious institute in Cairo. So he built the house right next door to me, and I got curious, and I started to read his diaries are translated into Hebrew. And I read that in Hebrew, and read his daughter's diary in English. It's called Jerusalem and I, by Khala Sakakini. And I discovered an incredible period of Jerusalem that I knew very little about. So I made this video. It's about the Sakakini house and another house, the Baramki house. Both of these houses are in neighborhoods that immediately after the war were housed with Jewish refugees, primarily from other areas of Jerusalem or from Arab countries, where Jews were not exactly expelled, but were certainly encouraged to leave, both by Israel and the Arab governments. And they arrived in Israel with nothing and were housed in border neighborhoods, in border towns, in transitory camps for a few years. And so there are a few stories of dislocation here, although my video focuses only on the dislocation of the Palestinians and their erasure of that history.
And what is the current incarnation of Akil Sakakini's house?
It was turned into a daycare center. I'm not sure why that house in particular. Maybe it's a coincidence. Maybe it is because it was somebody more famous. It's a daycare that's supported by Canadian Hadassah Vito. I think everyone knows about Hadassah, a fundraiser, a Jewish women fundraiser for Israel, primarily in Israeli hospitals. There are a couple of hospitals, Hadassah hospitals, and some other ventures, including this daycare.
And tell us about the other house that's featured in this short film.
Yeah, that house belonged to famous Palestinian architect, Andoni Baramki. He studied in Greece, and when he came back after his school, he did a lot of experimentation using Greek architecture style and local Palestinian. So his houses are very striking, fairly easy to recognize them around Jerusalem. And he built this house for his family and lived there until 1948, where it became literally the front line. So they were forced to leave, but they only moved a few blocks away, and they ended up on the Jordanian side of the border. And from the roof of their house, they could see this house for 19 years. And in 1967, they came back. All these years, because it was right at the tip of a kind of little peninsula into the border, it wasn't housed with a family, but it was actually, it became an outpost for the Israeli army. So it was in pretty miserable shape in 1967. Windows and doors were taken out and cement was put in, and all kind of shooting holes. And he went back to the Israeli authorities and he asked for his house back. And the authorities told him, we're sorry, you're an absentee. And they used a law that's called the absentee law, and whoever was absent from their house by a certain date in 1949, the house became the property of the government, and then later they sold it. Except for this house was not sold, it was used by the army, so they could have given it back, but of course giving it back would have opened the floodgate of other Palestinians asking for their property back. Andoni Baramki was shocked. He was a fairly old man at that point, and he just stood there and he said, how am I absent? Here I am. I'm present, and I'm showing you the paper, the ownership of my house. It didn't help him. And what happened was the house became a museum, municipal museum for the city of Jerusalem, with some kind of ancient history exhibitions in it. And in 2000, it opened in a new form as what's called Museum on the Seam, a museum of tolerance, understanding, and coexistence. And there's a lot of international money that went into this museum. It's an art museum, contemporary art museum, and they do these beautiful shows about conflict zones, about all kinds of areas of tension, social and political tension, but they do not acknowledge the actual history, the real history of this place. And I think.
Yeah, we've got a clip of this of the script describing the history of the house that is now this Museum of Tolerance.
The Baramkis appealed in the courts, but never got possession of their house again. Instead, it is a museum on the scene, and its history is recorded in the following sign. The Turjuman House was built in 1932 by the Arab Christian architect Anton Baramki, who purchased the site from Hassan Bey Turjuman. From 1948 to 1967, the house was used as an Israeli military outpost. Further down, the sign reads, "The idea of turning a military outpost into a site of peace and tolerance led to the opening of the museum on the Seam for dialogue, understanding, and coexistence." Dialogue and understanding? How can that be achieved if the museum does not fully disclose its own history? Not only is Andoni Baramki's name spelled wrong, but it is never mentioned that he did not simply build the house, but actually lived there with his family. It was his beloved home, which he visited daily until his death. I shall rewrite this sign.
And the next piece in the film is not only voiceover, but a script over, where you sort of superimpose different script over the plaque in the museum. Could you tell the listeners what your new version of the description of the house read and how it reads?
So I took the errors and crossed them out. I literally crossed them out, and I add text in red so that you can see what's added and you see the sign. And I basically say the right name, Andoni Baramki, and that he wasn't an Arab Christian, but he was a Palestinian. In Israeli discourse, Christians, Palestinians who are Christians, are often considered more cultured or educated or like us than Muslims. So it's another way to mark people and mark difference and erase difference and erase the national belonging. And I talk about the fact that he never got his house back, and that that the government didn't give it back to him. And I sort of, my ending is sort of a hopeful ending that the museum will take on itself to remedy that situation, or to fight, or to try to acknowledge this history and to try to change this present through its activities as a museum of coexistence, which of course right now it doesn't do, but it's a bit of a maybe naive but hopeful rendition of myself, by myself.
So that's just about it for the show today. Dorit, you've got a music request to close out the show.
This song is by Shlomo Bar and David Dao, and it's a song that is... Shlomo Bar is the first respectable musician of Middle Eastern descent. He's Moroccan Jew who got exposure to Ashkenazi audiences. And David Dao is of Oriental Jewish background too, but he's an opera singer, and you will hear that in the voice. And this song is called Guard the World, and it's addressed to a little child, and it basically says, "You child, you have to guard the world, because us adults, we have just failed." So this may be a good ending for us.
Great. Dorit, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's certainly a pleasure, and hope to have you back on soon.
I'd love to come again.
Great.
Thank you.
שאסור לראות תשמור על העולם ילד אם תראה תפסיק להיות גיבור של העולם ילד עם חיוך ש...
תשמור על העולם ילד כי אנחנו כבר לא מצליחים תשמור על העולם ילד אל תקסים במחשבות כי כמה שתדע יותר ילד אתה רק תבין פחות ובשעה מסוימת נסגרות כל הדלתות וכל האהבה נגמרת רק אתה ממשיך לטעות אסור לראות תשמור על העולם ילד אם תראה תפסיק להיות גיבור של העולם ילד עם חיוך של מלאכים תשמור על העולם ילד כי אנחנו כבר לא מצליחים